WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. No one wants a toxic waste dump, landfill, or incinerator located in their neighborhood. In fact, there's a school of thought in the environmental movement called NIMBY, not in my backyard. But since we continue to produce tons of hazardous waste each year, it has to go somewhere. In 1987, the Commission for Racial Justice of the United Church of Christ conducted a study and found that these toxins were being disproportionately dumped in Black, Hispanic, and Native American communities. And the head of the commission, Reverend Ben Chavis, coined the term environmental racism to describe the situation. My guest Robert Bullard wasn't surprised by the commission's findings. He had been studying the problem since 1978, when he joined the fight against a landfill plan for a Black neighborhood in Houston. Bullard, who's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Riverside, conducted a study of the siting of hazardous waste facilities throughout the southern United States. He published his findings in the book Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality. The EPA has responded to charges of environmental racism with a new report that says people of color and the poor are bearing a disproportionate environmental burden. But Bullard says the report doesn't go far enough.
I think the report is rather superficial in its analysis. It fails to examine the interplay between class and race. In all the studies that we've conducted over the last 10 years, we found that that race and class interpenetrates in siting decisions, and it's not an either or. When we look at racism in America, we can see that people of color are impacted at all class levels when it comes to siting.
What's the most convincing evidence you can offer that race is a very significant factor in determining where toxic dumps and toxic wastes are going to be located?
Well, if you look at the EPA's own Region 4, which is basically 8 states in the South, we find that there's not a shortage of poor white communities in the South. But if we try to find where the off-site commercial landfills are located in that region, right now in 1992, 100% of all of the commercial hazardous waste off-site landfills are located in zip codes that are predominantly Black. However, Blacks only make up about 20% of the population in that region. So it's not a class thing. It's not a poor poverty thing. If we look at other kinds of environmental toxins, whether it's lead, exposure to pesticides, toxic waste dumps, it's a combination of race and class.
So the problems that you're looking at include lead, toxic dumps, pollutants released into the air. Just give us a shopping list of the problems that you think Black communities and Hispanic communities are being most hard hit by environmentally.
Well, number one is lead. If we look at some other problems, we can include toxic waste incinerators, landfills, municipal landfills. We talk about chemical plants. You start naming pesticide, chemical refineries. We find all kinds of industrial facilities that happen to be located adjacent to communities of color and low-income communities, working-class communities. The emissions from the chemicals in Cancer Alley, for example, South Louisiana, that 85-mile stretch from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, it's created a nightmare, a chemical nightmare. An industrial sacrifice zone, and the people that live closest to these chemical plants are Black people. And these, in many communities, were founded right after slavery, before chemical companies even thought about going there.
There's an acronym that a lot of Americans have become familiar with, NIMBY. It's an acronym for Not in My Backyard. And this was the attitude that a lot of communities took when they found out that there was going to be a dump in their area, not in my backyard. Do you think that the NIMBY movement has, in its own way, backfired against Black communities? Because when one community said not in my backyard, it ended up in a Black community instead?
What has happened over the years is that the NIMBY phenomena basically was a white initiated community response to all kinds of locally unwanted land uses, or LULUs as commonly referred to. And what happened is that process of fending off noxious facilities in white communities drove these facilities toward the path of least resistance, which oftentimes meant communities of color. Oftentimes, black communities did not have chapters of Sierra Club, Audubon Society, National Wildlife Federation, Greenpeace, those kinds of organizations. And in many cases, they were preoccupied with basic economics. And in the cases where there were resistance, in many cases there were resistance, the resistance actually fell on deaf ear. Blacks did not have representatives on city council, on planning commissions, on boards that actually served their interests. And so it's like not having a person on a board that comes from the community where that's impacted makes a difference.
You've said that you think that black communities are more economically and politically vulnerable to incinerators and landfills and other forms of toxic dumps. What are some of the other ways that you think black communities have been more vulnerable?
Economics. I mean, if you talk about unemployment, if you talk about land use, if you talk about political power, not having individuals on boards and commissions, you talk about institutional barriers that prevent decision-making to be equitable across the board. And it's not just a black and white thing. I mean, we're talking about environmental issues that impact people of color, from native lands to the barrios, to the poverty pockets in Appalachia, et cetera. It's a matter of organizations having the political power to resist the onslaught of proposals to put landfills and incinerators, but at the same time having the economics to say no. And the economic blackmail is involved when communities are impoverished and don't have an economic tax base and are somehow given this dangling carrot of taking this incinerator with the promise of jobs. And that's a very powerful kind of message to send, to say take these jobs or unemployment.
So what do you think about the EPA's recommendations for protection? What exactly are they recommending?
Well, I think the EPA has taken 18 months to produce a report that is less than comprehensive. And I think it's when we went to EPA and ask them to address equity and to deal with areas of disproportionate impact, particularly for low-income and communities of color, we expected something concrete to come out of it. What they have produced is basically a document that really doesn't have a lot of meat.
What are some of your recommendations for ensuring more equity in how landfills are and toxic dumps are placed around our country?
I think even before we can even get to the point of siting, we have to get to the point of asking the question, do we need all of these hazardous waste incinerators? And talk about the role of the Environmental Protection Agency in pollution prevention. I mean, if recycling is the emphasis, then we may not need as many municipal solid waste incinerators. If EPA is right now pushing incinerators, there's no incentive to recycle.
So your agenda isn't about relocating dumps. It's about cutting down on pollutants so that we don't need to have more dumps?
Exactly. We're not advocating taking all of these poisons out of communities of color and putting them in white communities. We're not advocating that. There's some who see that as an option, but we're not saying that. We're saying that, and we are in total agreement with other environmentalists who say that there are some things that we have to bite the bullet on in terms of the amount of waste we create, you know, at the individual household level, as well as what we have to do with it. And so we're talking about a rational policy to deal with waste, a rational policy to deal with toxin, a rational policy to deal with all forms of environmental degradation.
Realistically, though, aren't there going to be a lot more landfills and incinerators before we really cut down on pollutants? And what do you propose that we do until we cut down on pollutants?
I think if the assumption is that we will always need landfills and incinerators, I think that what we're advocating is a rational plan of a fair share plan of equity, not targeting certain communities for these facilities, not saturating, not systematically allowing some communities to become sacrifice zones. We're talking about an equitable plan. If there's in a city where you have four quadrants, then make sure that all of the landfills are not in one quadrant. I mean, it has to be balanced. Everybody produces waste, so everyone should somehow bear the burden, bear the cost of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Bullard. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Riverside, and the author of a book called Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Bullard, author of the book Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality. Has anybody tried to prove environmental discrimination in the courts, and has there been any success in that area?
Well, there have been, you know, the first case that was filed in 1979, I was part of that. You know, I collected data for a lawsuit in Houston, Texas. And my wife was lawyer on that case, and we documented systematically that from the 20s up until 1978, the city of Houston had placed 100% of all its landfills in black communities, 6 out of 8 of the incinerators. And when the city didn't got out of the business of landfilling and turned it over to the private industry, 3 out of 4 of the privately owned facilities were located in black neighborhoods. We went to federal court, and basically the judge said that the statistics were overwhelming, but we could not prove that this was willful. And so it's very difficult. A more recent case was decided in Virginia, where King and Queen County, Virginia, 4 out of 4 of the landfills from the 60s up until 1991 were located in black neighborhoods in that county. However, the judge said it was not discrimination since the Board of Supervisors balanced economic, environmental, and cultural reasons. Now, we don't know what that means, but it seems to me that having the statistics and showing overwhelming disproportionate impact is not sufficient to prove discrimination in front of these judges today.
I'm wondering if any of the communities that you've studied have had any conspiracy theories to explain why more dumps and incinerators are being located in communities of color.
Well, we don't really need any conspiracy theories. I mean, we've documented systematically that decisions that are made to locate noxious facilities are not random. As a matter of fact, there was a report that was produced for the state of California, and it was done by a consulting firm here in L.A., Sorrell Associates. And it basically gave the advice of locating waste or energy facilities, you know, incinerators, in communities that are least likely to resist, meaning low-income, working-class communities, communities that are not likely to vote, no, those kinds of things. There's a report that was produced with tax money. In Dallas, Texas, for example, we documented that a lead smelter, all of the lead smelters in Dallas, by the way, located in black or Latino neighborhoods. And we documented that the city of Dallas could have closed this facility, this one facility located in West Dallas, could have closed it by enforcing a zoning ordinance. And this plant operated for 50 years, contaminating the community. You know, it sat across the street from a 3,500-unit public housing project, next door to an elementary school, next door to a boys' club, and nothing was done. And we have records to show that basically nothing was done for the simple reason that these were just poor black kids in the project and that it was a low-income black community.
There is a black environmental movement that's developed. I'm referring to the environmental racism movement. Where did the movement start? Is there a time and a place that you can trace it back to?
I think if we had to pick a point, it's probably in 1982 in Warren County, North Carolina, when the state decided to place a landfill in a poor black county. And it brought national attention and brought civil rights leaders, environmental leaders, social justice activists to converge on that community to say no. And that's when Dr. Ben Chavis from the Commission for Racial Justice coined the term environmental racism. But again, the impetus behind this equity movement springs from an extension of the civil rights movement. You know, the right to have clean air and clean water. A clean environment is considered a social justice issue, and I think it's not just a black issue.
As you've said, there were many blacks who used to see the environmental movement as a white middle-class movement. Why was the environmental movement seen that way?
Because that's what it was. It was basically organizations. The organized environmental movement was basically a white middle class phenomenon. And to some extent, that's the way it is today. But if we talk about increasing the numbers of people of color within those organizations as staff and as board members, but at the same time, strengthening and creating our own organizations, grassroots organizations of color, that's the fastest growing segment of the environmental movement. Small organizations that may not have environment in the name, but they deal with environmental issues, they deal with housing issues, transportation issues, health issues, all of those issues that they see as, in general terms, environmental.
Robert Bullard, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Robert Bullard is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Riverside, and author of Dumping in Dixie. We called Robert Wolcott, who chaired the EPA's Task Force on Environmental Equity. They've just completed their report analyzing race, class, and environmental risk. I asked Wolcott if the report contradicts the 1987 study by the Commission for Racial Justice of the United Church of Christ, which found race was the most prominent factor in choosing the location of commercial hazardous waste facilities.
Our study did not contradict that, but if I could expand on it for just a moment. I think it's clear that Hispanic and Black communities have been the subjects of greater than average exposures to the facilities that are cited there. I think it's also very important, however, to recognize that these firms that are siting these facilities are not necessarily operating strictly from a racial targeting basis. They are trying to make, I'm sure, enlightened, efficient business decisions. And in many cases, that involves relatively low cost and in many cases, rural land, frequently around concentrations of low-income racial minorities. So I think it's very important to recognize that while there are associations between them and clearly burdens that are borne, it is not explicit targeted racism that's determining this.
Now, your study concludes that people who are Black or Hispanic or people who are poor are bearing a disproportionate amount of environmental risk. I'm wondering, what's the long-term solution to have, like, wealthy people and middle-class people will have more exposure to toxics, too? Or, I mean what are we looking at, finally? Like, sharing the environmental risk together or ending the risks or what?
I think that the answer to this question is rooted in education, in enlightenment, and in, if you will, bringing to the surface many decisions which are so frequently left under the surface and not available to the broad public. I think we have to understand much better the demographics of our actions and the effects of those demographics on risk. I don't believe there's any kind of swift cure for this, quite frankly. I think all we can do is make significant strides in the right direction. I think the best way we can do this is to simply learn much more about where our most exposed populations are and how we can most rapidly and intelligently respond to this through our environmental authorities. I don't think EPA is brazen enough to purport to solve this thing in a month or a year or 5 years. It's a very complex array of risks out there that we're trying to deal with, and this is one more, I think, crucial layer that we try to bring. But EPA is already laden with extremely complex rules and regulations, and this is, as I say, just one more dimension we're going to try to bring to our task.
The activist movement has been using the word environmental racism. You use the word environmental equity. I wonder what you think of the expression environmental racism.
My concern with the expression is that it conveys intent. And I think that is an overstatement, at least in many cases. Clearly, there are perverse results that derive from actions out there that relate to siting, that relate to emitting that relate to a whole variety of activities. But I think it's very non-productive, if you will, to focus on its being racist in intent as distinct from inequitable in result. And the latter is as compelling a reason as the former to take positive action. But I think if we simply break it down into a debate as to whether it is pure racism or whether it is merely a result of class issues, I think it just the whole issue breaks down. I think we've just got to decide that there's a major problem out there of concentrations of risk, and let's go get it instead of pointing fingers.
When it comes to the decision of where a dump or an incinerator is going to be located, what role does the EPA play?
It's really important to emphasize here that EPA as an institution plays a very, very minor role in the whole siting area that has historically been and continues to be the domain of state and local government. It is unlikely to change in that regard. There are clearly some signals that we could and might send, but that responsibility is going to vest and remain at the local level. I think the clear suggestion there is that communities have to marshal their resources and information generally to kind of show what the distributions are and what the likelihood of effects are, and to bring it down into hard fact at the local regional level. But EPA and its regional offices have very, very limited ability to affect this pattern.
Robert Wolcott chaired the EPA's Task Force on Environmental Equity. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.